The Lares family has been distilling in America since 1698. And in this here episode, we're going to be hearing from 8th generation Lisa Lare Dunn about the history of the Lares family dating back to that time to present day. I mean, just imagine for a second being the family that holds the license with the number 1 from the Internal Revenue Service. I mean, that alone is kind of mind-boggling. Then couple that together with historical dates through the timeline of America back in 1698, the Revolutionary War, moving through the 18th century up into Prohibition, then post-Prohibition. I mean, the swath of info there is enormous, exciting, and is being brought to you today in this here episode. So get your cider ready, or perhaps a brandy sniffer is more appropriate for this chat, while we hear from 8th generation Lisa Lare Dunn and her family's history on how they put both apple brandy and apple jack on the map for America.
Hey, apples, make them pop. Pop, 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 pop.
Hey, 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 my name is Rhea Windcaller, and I am the producer and cider MC of this weekly podcast, where we speak with makers, cider enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world.
Hip, hip, hooray!
Hello, Ciderville. I am like on the edge of my seat, excited to be able to share with you this episode this week, because I've been editing the recording that I did with Lisa Lare Dunn earlier this August. It was considered, I guess, the hottest day of the year. So, of course, we're meeting in New Jersey at the main headquarters, which also happened to be the Lares family home at one part of its history. I mean, think about it. When you are a 324-year-old family business, and just pause on that for a second, 324, because I did the math, 1698 to 2022, that's 324 years. There's a lot of info. So this conversation, I had a sit-down visit with Lisa, and that's where we started. Then we did a tour around the facility going into the barrel room. You're going to hear that on part two. You're going to hear from Lisa's father, Larry Lares, who is supposed to be retired, but this guy who's like a master distiller, you know, and obviously the family's doing something right because he's still there every day. I met her father, Larry, and her mother, who also showed up like during the conversations, really kind of a family scene, and her son, Gerard, who is 10th generation and is now working at the facility. So both Gerard and Larry will be in part two. And yowza, I mean, it takes my breath away. And it was so cool to be able to have this conversation with Lisa, who's so approachable. Again, I want to state what this family has done right in so many ways to be able to keep that legacy going. We're going to be getting some tips on that in this here conversation, because it's not easy for family members to stay in business, let alone like 5, 10 years, or even 100 years. But to do that so well and to continue to grow the business and maintain that vision and stay a family who's loving each other throughout it all, through thick and thin, that's something. That's a story alone. So we're going to hit upon that, go through the history of how this family made it through both, well, the American Revolution, where they started, you know, in New Jersey, how they branched out in along the East Coast, where they're sourcing their apples from, which is Virginia. We'll talk a little bit more about that in part two, and some of the technical aspects of their distillation process, getting through Prohibition, and where they are today and where they are going, because they are not going away. I mean, shoot, in years to come, somebody will be interviewing the 20th generation of the Lares family. I have no doubt about that. It's just an amazing opportunity. I've been wanting to talk to them for such a long time, and it just was perfect because Lares & Company is going to be at Cider Days 2.0. So if you haven't heard about that yet, I'll talk a little bit about that upcoming event this November, right after we take a pause.
Ba-dum, ba-dum. There's a reason why we do it like this. Ba-dum, ba-dum. There's a
Saturdays 2.0 is taking place the first weekend of November, which is the 4th and 5th of this coming November, in my special spot of Ciderville, which is Western Massachusetts. And all the events for 2.0 are taking place at the Hawks and Reed Performing Arts Center. And there's a lot going on there. In fact, right now, you could go to the webpage for Saturdays 2.0 and start seeing the schedule of events specifically for Saturdays 2.0. And also leading up to that weekend, we have Western Mass Cider Week and also surrounding different events happening in our area. Because anyone who knows Saturdays, which first started in 1994, is the oldest cider fest in the country. Not quite 300 years old, but you know, I think we're almost touching our 30th year. So that's not bad for something that was not even talked about in the early 1980s. Of course, back when the Laird's family was distilling, you know, cider was the drink. But I'm getting off course here, right? I just can't stop talking about that. Back to Cider Days 2.0. The kickoff event takes place on the 4th, a Friday evening, and it's going to be a Calvados and American Apple Brandy. And we're going to have Laird's 7.5-year-old brandy at that tasting, along with another American Apple Brandy from Flag Hill Winery and Distillery, which is based in New Hampshire. You're going to be hearing a conversation that I had at Flag Hill Winery and Distillery coming up on an upcoming episode of Cider Chat. So there's a lot there. In addition to 4 Calvados from Normandy, France. And one of those Calvados is from Domaine du Pont. If you want to hear a little bit about Domaine du Pont, I have a fantastic already posted episode with Etienne du Pont, where we were going through a whole like range of Calvados and tasting with a master. Like, there's just nothing like it. It's like sitting down with Larry Lairs and going through that whole range of brandies that they have there. And this is going to get us all stoked for that actual kickoff event. I want to say that the Calvados and American Apple Brandy tickets are selling, and I don't want you to miss out. You want to find the link for that. It's at ciderchat.com. There's a page called Saturdays 2.0. I'm going to have the links in that. Check us out on social media. On the Facebook page, you're going to see it posted right there for the tickets. And it is really a guided tasting. So you're going to be hearing about how it's distilled, the regions that it's distilled, and how to taste it, which is different than tasting cider. I will be presenting that tasting along with Ambrosia Borowski, who is a rock star, brandy expert, and cider expert, and is the general manager of the Northman Beer and Cider Bar. Super stoked. So don't miss out on those tickets. Go to the show notes for this year podcast, or go to ilovesiderdays.com. You'll be directed to that, be able to get your tickets. Now, there's a bunch of other events happening too. I can't go through them all right now because that's a show unto its own. So go to the schedule page for Cider Days 2.0. You'll see all the 2.0 events happening in addition to some of the earlier events taking place during Western Mass Cider Week and also on the Cider Days weekend itself. There's going to be events added as they come our way. Even the cider pop-up for 2.0 is wild. You know, we have Claude Jacquelaire. We're going to have Matt Kaminsky there, authors of cider books. And I can't say this enough, bookmark these things. Pay attention to social media because you don't want to miss out. There's both ticketed events and free events too, all waiting for you this first weekend of November in Western Massachusetts and the Berkshires. Now you might be thinking, oh my goodness, it's the fall, there's apples. People are crushing apples, getting juice and fermenting now, and I want to get in on that. I want to make cider and start right out the gate doing that well. Well, I have a tip for you. In fact, they are sponsors of this here podcast, and it is a company that provides yeast to cider makers, specific cider making yeast, and that would be Fermentist. They're actually an international company and work with a whole range of different cultured yeast for both winemakers and cider makers. I mean, you could use a wine yeast. A lot of people do. But sometimes you want to have something that's really specific to the fruit that you're working with. And that's what Fermentis does. And I've used all their different yeast for my own ciders. You know, I will be foraging apples out in the fall season, you know, on the roadsides, pulling them in and saying, you know, dang, I might be thinking, okay, a little bit of wild yeast, but then I want to follow up with the cultured yeast, which is really pretty typical. I'm finding that more and more with all the different conversations I have with both professional makers and folks like myself who are just doing it at home. We might let it run a little bit wild and then add a cultured yeast, but there's some ciders I want to just from the get-go take charge and create a certain profile. Perhaps I want it on the sweeter side or the opposite, a very dry cider. And the yeast is going to help dictate that because it's munching up on the sugars that are in the fresh pressed apple juice and converting it to alcohol. And if you don't take control of that, well, what will happen is all the floaty yeast that's in the air or on the cider making equipment or in the room that you have, or perhaps, you know, just on the apples themselves, they might be the coolest yeast around and that might be something to go to. But there are times, definitely times, when I want to have a focus for my cider, kind of tried and true. And Fermentis is super reliable for that. Plus, they're very approachable. That's Fermentis.com. Time now to hear the history of Laird's and Company dating back to 1698 to present day, the first licensed distillery in America. And they bear the letter number one on their door to their barrel room. Definitely check out the photo to that in the show notes to this here episode 333. Everywhere on this property is history. You just feel it as soon as you like drive by the site or pull into the yard. We met in the old home of the family at one time and is now the corporate headquarters. I traveled in, you know, it's kind of like walking into anyone's home in a way, and you just felt like a certain peacefulness. It tells you a lot about a business, the way that just the feeling is. I made my way upstairs into the top conference room, and along the way, wall hangings everywhere with photographs of different relatives over the year. That alone was just kind of like I'm walking into a time capsule. Then I stepped down into this main conference room, which is all wood paneled, and all around the room are these like artifacts from days gone by and also future plans, which you will be hearing about in this episode. There, Lisa Lair and I, who is the eighth generation Lair to be part of the company. She is both the global ambassador and the chief operating officer. We had a sit-down conversation with her faithful dog, Jack, at her side. And of course, for a family who is renowned for Applejack, of course you're going to name your dog Jack, right? In part two, you're going to be hearing about the technical aspects, and I'll be taking a walk about with both Lisa and her father, Larry. I have to say that even now, with weeks gone by from my visit and re-editing this episode, the conversations to bring it to all of you out there in Ciderville, I'm still impacted by their history and just meeting the modern day Lairs right now. Really wonderful people, very personable. Wait till the end because you're going to be hearing tips about how to keep a family business together. And maybe not even a business, but a family. Because to be able to be a 300 plus year old family, you got to be doing something right. And we'll be talking about that. So make sure to grab a glass of Lair's Applejack brandy, perhaps, if you're all so lucky. and join this chat with Lisa Lair's Dunn of Lair's and Company. We're looking back at 1698.
Mm-hmm.
And that was with Robert Lair.
Actually, that was Alexander.
Alexander,
and his two sons, William and Thomas.
Okay.
Came here from, they were fleeing from Scotland. It was when the English were persecuting the clans. So they fled to the New World. They came across on a boat called a ship called the Caledonia. And they arrived here in 1698. Settled here in Monmouth County, New Jersey, where we're still located. Mm-hmm. We only moved a mile and a half down the road in our 300-year history here. But we are pretty certain that William was a distiller, and obviously being from Scotland, they were, you know, the home of Scotch whiskey. Sure, he knew how to distill when he came over mm-hmm. here. When they arrived, at that point in time, apples... the only natural apple here is the crab apple. But in the early 1630s, the English brought over apple trees and apple seeds, and the apple trees flourished very well in this area. Mm-hmm. So there was an abundance of apples, and he started making his whiskey, or actually apple brandy, cider spirits.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to imagine what this area looked like back at that time, because I've actually fallen hard for New Jersey. I'm just finding it so lovely. The people are so lovely. Right across the street, there's an orchard. Mm-hmm. And then down the road is like a little reservoir. And across the street is like open fields and fields.
Mm, horse farms.
Okay.
We're very well known for horse raising mm-hmm. and training here in this area.
And what were apples... being grown here by your family, how did that first come about? It was just kind of probably the quantity being used at that mm-hmm. time was much less than you're now in 2022, yes. Of course. So were they using like crab apples and some of these English varieties that were brought over back then? Do you have any idea?
Obviously, that's the only source of apples they had at that point in time. Yeah. So I'm sure they were the cider apples that came across from England and probably using some crab apples as well. Mm-hmm. I assume they had orchards as well. They had quite a bit of land. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like people were purchasing apples. You know, back in the 1600s, 1700s, and even into the 1800s, there basically was no use for the apple tree except to produce hard cider or cider mm-hmm. spirits. Mm-hmm. They were very bitter. We called them basically spitters. You took a bite out of it and you just spit it out because it was so high in tannins. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure they were growing most of their own apples. If property had a lot of cider trees or cider apple trees mm-hmm. that were on their property, they were usually producing hard cider or cider spirits. Mm-hmm. You know, back then there were two production methods for applejack. One was freeze distillation or evaporate, let's just call it freeze distillation, mm-hmm. Where they would crush the apples, ferment, and they would leave it in the barrel throughout the winter. And as it became cold, the water would freeze out of the applejack, the hard cider, and it would condense the alcohol level. But this was a very harsh method. Because, you know, when you use heat distillation, you're moving a lot of the, I guess, some of the congeners. Obviously, you want some of them, mm-hmm. But you need to remove some of the fusel oils, methanol, etc., mm-hmm. in order to have a more palatable product. Mm-hmm. So, historically, the freeze distillation method created a harsher product. Mm-hmm. There was actually a term called apple palsy. If you drank too much of the freeze distilled applejack, because if it had too much fusel oils, etc.,
you'd have a little bit of numbness on your
face. Numbness, you're getting yet.
A little something could go on there. My goodness, yeah.
But also, you know, it had some picturesque nicknames. You know, Corpse Reviver was one. Corpse Reviver.
Reviver.
Like it would revive a corpse. That's how potent it was. Mouth of Bluefish Quills. So it...
Mouth of Bluefish
Quills. Yes. So it was a much harsher product.
Yeah.
With William being a distiller and coming from Scotland, obviously, I'm not sure if he brought a still with him, or he most likely knew how to build a still. Mm-hmm. But as early as the 1700s, there were stills available here in the New World. So he used the heat distillation. We're pretty confident of that.
Moved over into that, yeah. Because a lot of folks, even today, do try their hand at Applejack. I'll raise my hand to that.
Yes,
living
yes.
in New England, I'm able to put out some mm-hmm. cider. And I've never been fond of it.
No,
it's never not, been fond
it's,
of
it's
it.
It's not no. that palatable.
No, yeah, it's not so exciting. Mm.
But they do think Applejack, the name came from, because freeze distillation was also called jacking.
Mm-hmm.
So you're jacking the apple cider. Mm-hmm. So there's theories that that is where the name Applejack came from, which is probably true, but who knows?
Yeah, yeah.
Nobody wrote that down.
Nobody wrote it down. I know they're just trying to survive. Mm-hmm. There's yeah. Let's go over a little bit of your family tree. They came over, and then how did the lineage go from there? Because you're ninth generation, which is outstanding. I mean, congratulations to your family for, like, keeping that on, because that's really unique. It's not just a 100-year family. It's a 300-year family. And in the same area, that's really commendable. So where did that then go from there? Then they came over and they started doing the distillation.
Well, I'm sure when William started this enterprise and started producing Applejack, apple brandy, cider spirits, he had no clue that 10 generations later that his descendants would right. still yeah. be plugging along and continuing his initial operation. But as I said, we settled here in Monmouth County, but the town is Colts Neck. Mm-hmm. In 1717, the Colts Neck Inn was built. It was a stagecoach stop.
Is that right down here on the corner?
Yes, it's right on the corner of 34 and Route 537.
Mm-hmm. I actually stayed there last night.
Oh, really?
I did. I found them very pleasant, and it was very cute. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's the inn
spot.
that's up, yeah. You know, the hotel is down in that little ravine.
Yes.
That's actually where our initial distillery was, at that location.
Wow. Well, that was meant to be,
yeah.
me being there. No wonder
you,
I was
feeling. No idea.
That's
pretty cool.
Wow. So that was the original location.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There looks like there's a little bit of water there that
yes.
might have provided some source that they needed.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So the Laird family, we did not own the Colts Neck Inn. It was owned by the Hart family. And when Mary Hart became a widow, the Laird family ran the inn for her. So we were like proprietors of the inn. Mm-hmm. And obviously we had the still, the distillery right next door.
Right there, yeah. I'm
We obviously were serving our cider spirits at
yeah.
the Colts Neck Inn. So that's really how word started to spread about the product, because as people would come through traveling from the ports, you know, to
Philadelphia,
yeah. Pennsylvania.
Yeah. New York. Maybe not New York.
You know, they would take it with them.
Yeah.
You know, obviously it wasn't in bottles that early. It was more in barrels. That's how it was transported. But so word began to spread, and obviously we were serving quite a bit of it in the Colts Neck Inn.
It's just kind of giving me a little bit of pause there
mm-hmm.
on how your family is so tied into this area. Like your roots go deep here.
Very deep here.
Very
yes,
deep.
Yes.
Yeah.
And even, you know, with the growth of the country, you know, we have a timeline that shows the historical moments of the growth of the United States. Mm-hmm. Along and on the bottom area, it's the growth of the Laird family and the product mm-hmm. and the company, and how we tie into so many different time periods of the growth of the United States,
mm-hmm.
which is pretty cool.
It absolutely is, because one thing that is true, no matter what happens in the world, people are always going to want a bit of something to sip that helps one relax, enjoy mm-hmm. life, kind of step away from it. And the hard work that people were doing to build the country at that time, spirits is like a major foundation for that, I think, for any kind
yes.
of growth of any
mm-hmm.
country, and certainly the U.S. And I think that's also something to be noting for listeners, how much that actually did help the
mm-hmm.
U.S. in a way to provide that.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a sustenance in a way to keep
Absolutely.
You going forward and having faith and loosening up and the fun of it, too. And then it sounded like the quality kind of changed, too, you know, soon
oh,
once they got that and knew how
mm-hmm.
to distill
and moved away from the freeze distillation mm-hmm. part of it.
And that was a lot. The freeze distillation was a lot of farmers if they had mm-hmm. apple trees. So they would, you know, not everybody owned a still.
Yeah.
And it was almost, it was like a community project. You know, churches would have stills. And the congregation would all bring their apples as a group, and they would produce the cider spirits, and then they would take their share back with them. So it was almost like a community project for some people that did not own stills.
My goodness. Yeah, I didn't know that, that churches mm-hmm. own stills. I kind of... Makes sense, yeah. right? Monks and all that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it goes back. The Trappists making their ales and all mm-hmm. whatnot. Very interesting. So from the Colts Inn, then what was the next progression from there? How did that come that you came to this location? We're in like the mm-hmm. family home, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, we were at the Colts Neck Inn for quite a while, up until 1849. there was quite a while we were at that
so
location.
So that was during... The actual Revolutionary War.
The Colts Neck Inn was used as a meeting place for the planners of the Revolution.
Wow.
One very famous revolutionary person in this area was Joshua Huddy. And there's actually a Huddy's Tavern down the street that's yeah. named after him. But he was eventually hung by the British, but he wrote his last will and testament on the head of a barrel, and then they hung him from that barrel, which, man, maybe it was one of ours, who knows?
Yeah, I have no doubt. So that you were there until like in 1849. So let's back up a little bit, because here is the American Revolution. Mm-hmm. We're not too far from Delaware, right? And George Washington. Can we talk a little bit about that? Because
absolutely,
the president, President Washington, wrote about your family in his diary. It's not lore. I mean, it's true.
It's not lore. It's pretty cool, actually, especially in this area. You know, it's always George Washington was here. He slept yeah. here and so yes. forth. So this was, you know, the Battle of Monmouth was a very pivotal battle during the Revolution, which was not very far down the road. My four greats grandfather, Robert Laird, and his brother Richard were Revolutionary War dragoons under George Washington's command at that
point
in time.
You said war?
Dragoons. They were called dragoons.
Dragoons.
Yes.
Dragoons.
Mm-hmm.
Soldiers?
Yes, they were okay. soldiers. Dragoons. Yes. Richard was an officer, Robert was not.
Okay.
It's been passed down through the family that we did supply the troops with Applejack. And I, you know, when I do presentations and talk about it, I just think, you know, what gave those young men the stamina to go across the Delaware that cold Christmas Eve night and surprise the British? And I said, they had to be fortified with Applejack, right?
I believe it.
I totally believe that.
I absolutely. Mm. That was not in the middle of mm-mm. July or
no,
August.
No, no. But a really interesting story and anecdote about the family is... about Elijah Laird, who was Robert and Richard's uncle. And as George Washington traveled during the battles, he would hire a local person to be their guide, because obviously he did not know the local terrain as he went through the 13 colonies. Mm-hmm. And Elijah Laird was his guide here in Monmouth County. And George Washington and his officers were hosted in the Laird family home, not this one here, for a meal. So he didn't sleep in our home, but he was hosted by the Laird family for a meal. And so he did partake and enjoy our Laird's Applejack. You know, George Washington did write to my ancestor, Robert Laird, yeah. Asking how to produce the cider spirits or mm-hmm. Applejack, as he had a surplus of apples at Mount Vernon.
That's right, yeah. Do we know if he provided the recipe and told him how to do that?
I am pretty sure that he did. There are references in George Washington's diary discussing the building staves and casks for cider spirits. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So he did begin to produce some cider spirits. Mm-hmm. He was much smaller level. I mean, obviously he was the largest distiller of his time period, but it was predominantly whiskey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, so fascinating. Now, in 1780 is when there was a commercial license. Is that, or is that how one would look at it, or that there is actually a bill of sale? Because was there any regulation at that point?
No, not really. It was kind of like a free-for-all back then.
Yeah, wild
west. You know, until the whiskey revolution.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
But, yeah, it's, we use 1780 as our official start date, or in, you know, the beginning of the company, because we do have Robert Laird's account book of operations mm-hmm. from the late 1700s mm-hmm. and has a record of sale of cider spirits.
Mm-hmm. But of course we know the Colts Inn, and up to that point you, the family was there and selling it for
yes,
sure.
Yes. So, you know,
yeah,
there was probably bartering going on,
yeah.
selling, you know, obviously people were consuming it in the inn, in the tavern.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yes. So then you moved up this way around 1849.
Yes, family. We had, I guess it was Robert Laird's son, Samuel, took over the distillery in 1812. And he was running the Colts Neck Inn, running the distillery. And another quick anecdote is he was a very famous race horse trainer, which this area is very well known for. One of the most famous horses was a horse named Fashion, which she was inducted into the Racing Hall of Fame in 1980, which coincidentally was her bicentennial, which is pretty funny.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, he was doing all three, and unfortunately we had a fire. You know, you have wood, fire with the distilleries. It was quite prevalent to have fires.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And at that point, his son, Robert, a second Robert, moved the distillery to our current location about a mile and a half down the road.
Down the road, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
To where we are now.
Yes.
Yes. And the building is still here that where the...
Mm-hmm. Some of the buildings are. Yeah. We can take a look at that later.
Yeah. You know, there's a longer piece here because you're in two locations, both here and in Virginia.
Yes. Yes.
Where you source your apples from.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I want to just kind of put a pin on that. We'll come back to those,
okay.
those apples. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about Prohibition.
Okay.
Because my understanding is that the company was able to continue to distill during Prohibition.
Not in the early stages.
So early stages is like how many years are we talking about?
It was most of Prohibition...
Most of Prohibition.
We were not distilling.
Okay. How were you surviving?
We were producing some non-alcoholic apple products.
Okay. Like an apple juice.
Yeah, apple juice, apple cider, which I'm not sure how many people were really buying a large quantity of apple cider except local bootleggers.
Mm-hmm.
So we could have been selling to bootleggers, and who knows.
Possibly.
My family could have been bootlegging
possibly.
And not,
right.
I have no
Most
idea.
Most families were, mine was. So,
exactly, yeah. right? My grandfather was producing an apple soda called Five Apple. So my grandfather then petitioned the federal government for a license or a permit to produce for medicinal purposes during Prohibition. There were a few whiskey distilleries that were doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And he was granted that. We were allowed to distill 1 million gallons of apple brandy for medicinal purposes, which is kind of crazy. You know, there were prescriptions for spirits.
Like we were saying, during war, it was like the thing to kind of calm the soldiers, no
exactly,
doubt. And
exactly.
And fortify them, of course,
mm-hmm,
too. So
mm-hmm.
absolutely makes sense.
When my grandfather and great uncle reopened the distillery when it was still Prohibition, there's newspaper articles saying that owner was afraid of hijackers and gangsters because coming and stealing the alcohol. So,
oh, I'm sure.
It's quite interesting. But
were there bars on the window or anything like that?
Well, there are bars on the warehouse.
Yeah,
yes.
I'm sure.
Yes,
yeah,
uh-huh.
absolutely.
Absolutely, yeah. We do.
Yeah,
there
that's one of the main things now to get a license to distill.
Mm-hmm.
You need to show that it's a secure building.
Exactly.
For that
mm-hmm.
and for other reasons too. But yeah, hijackers and robbers. Were there any ever? Was that ever a problem? Do you know?
I don't think it was.
Yeah.
Because he, you know, they didn't receive the permit until 1933. So it was right at the
okay.
tail end.
Yeah.
But we know that's where the mob came from. That's where it all began, was during Prohibition. So there was a lot of violence going on.
Do you know if that was a difficult thing for your family to stay out of in that way, the mob? Was there pressure?
I have no idea.
Yeah. Kind of curious because of bootlegging and, you know, stuff happening up in Vermont at that time. You know, those cars that became like the race cars that come over the border and whatnot. I imagine that there was a lot of that kind of maybe backdoor dealings, and to come out of that unscathed is also commendable.
Well, and, you know, New Jersey, there was quite a bit of, you know, rum and foreign products that were smuggled in along the shoreline. And Atlantic City was a huge central area for the mob and bootlegging and so forth. So New Jersey was very involved. And, you know, when Applejack was very prevalent during Prohibition because it was considered a safer product to drink that was bootlegged.
Why is that? Why was it considered safe?
You know, bathtub gin, you know, a lot of people that are making with their own stills.
Cutting it with something that you don't know.
And also if the too high of methanol, you know, many people became blind. People actually perished from the bathtub gin. You might have gotten a pretty bad headache from some of the Applejack, but it was safer to consume.
Yeah, what a time. We can't even fathom it.
But, no.
Here we are, still surviving. So out of Prohibition, the company kind of moved forward. And let's talk a little bit about your dad coming in at that point, or is there any in between?
Yeah, there's a little, there's a in between period because my grandfather and his brother, Joseph, it was John Evans Laird, my grandfather, and Joseph Tilton Laird III, reopened the distillery, and it was basically the heyday of Applejack. You know, we had, you know, there's so many bootleggers of Applejack, so people were familiar with the product.
I'm thinking that they could make it, you know, oh, just freeze it, it's fine, I'm going to drink it, and then like, oh, that's good.
And post-Prohibition, many of the local bootleggers went into the legal operation. So there was hundreds of Applejack producers back then. We had inventory, so we were immediately available into the marketplace, which was gave us a leg up. So it was really the years that Applejack was booming, up in, you know, 30s into the 40s, so much so that we purchased two other distilleries in 1941. Our current distillery in North Garden, Virginia, outside of Charlottesville. And we also purchased a distillery in Syracuse, New York.
Oh, okay.
And well, it wasn't actually Syracuse. It was Lyons, New York, outside of very far from Syracuse. So we had three distilleries running consecutive or at the same time.
Quite the demand.
There was quite a demand. And one thing to keep in mind, because we are, our product is produced from apples, 100% apples. So we only could distill September through December, when we could source the apples. You know, there was no such thing as cold storage.
Right.
You know, so we had to distill during that time period. So with that time constraint, we needed the additional distilleries to have enough product for the demand that was going on at that point in time.
My goodness. Is that Syracuse or outside of Syracuse plant still?
No, there was a fire there.
Oh, dear.
So that was another fire. And that was during... well, we had two fires during World War II. We were dehydrating the apple pomace to produce pectin. And pectin was used as a food preservative for the war rations.
Huge demand for that.
You know, and you know how everybody during World War II stepped up and did their part for the war effort. And that's what the Laird family did.
Right.
We did have a fire at North Garden, but thankfully it was a separate area. And we also had a fire at Lyons, New York. Now, I'm not sure if that's the one that shut that particular distillery down. The date right now is escaping me.
That's okay. But just to kind of let folks listening know, in terms of fires, with distilling, it was basically, I mean, now it's modernized, so people are using like a, you know, a propane or type of system, but with wood. I mean, that's how it was all, you know, being heated up, and that caused a lot of awful fires and globally in different parts. And even still, there's recent fires because there's some folks in different parts of the world still distilling that way.
Well, and also it's very combustible.
Yes.
So if you don't have the correct...
The spirit itself.
Yes, it's high proof. If you aren't using the correct ventilation...
There, does not go out with water.
No.
Right. And once it gets fire.
You can have explosions, which can be very dangerous. So
yeah, wow. Well,
you have to be careful.
Yeah.
So now, my father wasn't born until 1940. My grandfather passed away very suddenly. In 1950. My father has a brother who was about 20 years older than him. So there was kind of like my grandfather had two marriages. So my uncle, John Evans Laird Jr., who went by Jack Laird, my grandfather passed away very suddenly. And so my grandmother had to step in. And
this was the first time maybe that a woman...
First time a woman, and she kind of got thrown into it.
1950, did you say?
1950.
Wow, what a poignant time for a woman to come.
Exactly.
In the U.S.
Exactly.
Wow.
So she was overseeing the company while Jack was, he wasn't quite old enough, you know, he was still learning. So then my Uncle Jack, he... took over the company. And it was later on that my father came in once he was of age. He was big in the distillery. When I was a child, he was distilling, you know, up late hours, especially, you know, we're only running during the fall months, so didn't see much of him in the fall.
Goodness.
So, but he came into the company and they worked together for quite a while until my uncle retired. They expanded and diversified the company. Once we moved into the late 1960s, 70s, and especially into the 80s, consumers were moving away from brown spirits. They wanted lighter type spirits.
Gin,
rum, vodka. Also, at this point in time, straight rye started to disappear. Became blended whiskey. It was lightened with neutral grain or vodka. Scotches became blended. So they diversified. But one interesting anecdote at this point in time, and it's probably our, well, it is, it's not probably, it is our most distributed product is our blended Laird's Applejack.
Yes. Around
1972, that product was created. It was about 1968. That we petitioned the federal government for a new federal standard of identity.
Yeah, I want to talk about that because that isn't easy. I mean, cider, even now in 2022, is having a lot of difficulty getting its category really set. So what was that like back in 72? Must have been a little bit of weight behind the family to be able to get that done.
Yeah, they really, you know, worked with the government, and there must have been, you know, my grandfather was very involved with the original, I guess you would call it, industry trade organization.
Sure.
So he was very involved in, he was actually the mayor of the town, involved with all the federal regulations and working with the government post-prohibition. So I guess he must have had some pull.
Yeah.
The family.
You got to know some of these things.
And what happened is as... the other brown spirits could lighten their product and be more palatable to the new consumer tastes. We kind of were stuck. Our federal standard of identity for apple brandy, Applejack, which are synonymous, has to be 100% apples. We could add nothing to it.
Right.
So this is where Jack Laird went and asked, we need, you know, in order we need to survive, you know, we need to be able to lighten our product. So as of 1972, we have the federal standard of identity of blended Applejack. Now that can be as little as 20% apple brandy and then the balance neutral grain, which is the base of vodka. Ours is 35% apple brandy, 65% neutral grain. So this allowed the company to continue and to survive, mm-hmm. But also we diversified into other spirits because we knew we couldn't keep our doors open with just Applejack any longer yeah. and our apple brandy. Yeah. So we did create other types of spirits, and then later on we started importing wines as well, wines mm-hmm. and spirits from other countries.
From Europe mm-hmm. and whatnot, yeah. And now it's kind of like a multinational type of situation where you're importing, you're an importer, and mm-hmm. also the distillers mm-hmm. here, which and, is makes sense. Mm-hmm.
And that's where my father's, who my father was Larry Laird, his contribution to the continuance of the company and the family business is diversifying. Mm-hmm. We also started contract bottling for other package, other distillers, mm-hmm. Contract packaging. So we found all these different avenues to have a revenue source mm-hmm. to keep the company
yeah.
alive.
Yeah, yeah. With the heart and soul being the apple.
Always, always, always.
Applejack. Yeah. Always. So cool. Very cool. Well, absolutely makes sense. It's what farmers have to do. You add those value-added products. It's what distillers have to do. Mm-hmm. And here you are still surviving. So your father came along, and then you stepped up to the plate. Well, when did you actively get involved? And I know also your son is, Gerard is involved now.
Well, during my later high school years and college, I worked here on my summer breaks. So I worked in different capacities. Mm-hmm. I was in quality control and production. I was at one point, I was in the accounting department, worked under the treasurer. And then I went into sales, but once
wow, everything, kind of knowing a little bit of everything.
You have to learn every aspect yeah. of the business to understand everyone's job and what they're up against and what they're dealing with
for it, yeah.
day in and day out. So once I graduated from college, I went to college to be a veterinarian. You know, I was kind of torn. Do I want to be, you know, the first wow. female basically that rises to the yeah. top in the company, yeah. you know, becomes that executive? Yeah. Or be a veterinarian. I've a love for animals. Got to college and it finally dawned on me, like, what are you, crazy? You know, you have this heritage. I'm an only child. You know, my cousin was involved at that point, but I decided.
Was there pressure for that?
Absolutely none. You know, I give my father a lot of credit, especially yeah. only having one child, that I never felt any pressure. Which I think was why I'm here. I think if I was pressured, I might not be here. Because, you know, it's one thing I've done with my children. It has to be your passion. It can't be, couldn't be my father's. Mm-hmm. It couldn't be mine. Mm. You know, you have to develop that passion and want to. It has to be your desire and you want to do it. Because if you're not happy, it's not good for you and it's not good for the company.
Right.
And then it's just, it's going to fester.
Yeah.
And it'll be toxic.
Yes.
So I think it's very important to have that passion mm-hmm. and want to continue the mm-hmm. heritage. So that finally, and I love history. And I went to a very historical college where actually George Washington, it's the 10th oldest college in the country, very small liberal arts school called Washington College in Chestertown, Maryland. But George Washington actually donated 50 guineas to start the school and was on the Board of Visitors and Governors. So there was that
full
little tie-in here,
full circle
to George Washington. And I think I got on that campus, and it was such a historical campus. And I'm what am I doing? You know, the light bulb went out, and I made my decision.
And you came on board. Wow.
Yes.
Well, I'm sure your love of animals, you know, is still being able to be fed because we have Jack, your little pup here on the floor. And I saw little kittens outside.
They keep multiplying. We have to catch them and take care of that. But
yeah,
Jack was born at the distillery in
no
North
kidding.
Garden. So
wow.
he's Applejack, but we call him Jack.
I'm imagine there's been a couple of Jack dogs over the years from the family. That's great.
I remember when my aunt, Mary Lee, who was married to Jack, and Jack had passed away at that point, and we had Jack, and I told her the name of the dog, and she's like, "You didn't name that dog after Uncle Jack, did you?" I said, "No. Applejack, because he was born at the distillery."
I was wondering the same thing.
Yeah, she was like, "You didn't name your dog." I was like, no.
Applejack makes absolute sense.
He was born at the distillery. It makes sense, right?
Yeah. So let's just talk about your position now. So your title is like Global Ambassador.
Chief Operating Officer and Global Ambassador. So as a family business, you wear a lot of hats. But I worked my way through the company. I didn't just step into an executive position, which I think is very important in a family business, because you have to earn the respect of your coworkers and realize that you're a hard worker and that you're willing to get your hands dirty. I loved production. I did not want to go into sales. They kind of took me kicking and screaming because they're like, "You are the family member that should be the face of the company." They're all, "You're a young woman." And so, okay, I'll go along with this. And
you love history.
And I love history. I love talking about history. I love talking about the family. I love talking about the company.
The public face,
But it took a while for me to get that confidence because I really was not a public speaker. I still get nervous. I'll be like, ooh,
Sure.
Like the deer in the headlights.
That could be a good thing.
I guess it is. Yeah. But I started small in New Jersey and then spread out to other markets. And then as we moved into probably about late 1990s and year 2000, you started to see the explosion of the craft cocktail. The bartenders were moving back to classic cocktails, fresh ingredients, and they started taking notice of our apple brandy, and they wanted the original ingredient that was in these classic cocktails from the late 1800s, early 1900s. So I became more involved with the bartending community and traveling, and as we started exporting, we now export into 17, 18 markets, and I visit all markets around the world and do master classes and talk about the product and the history and cocktails, and it's not bad traveling around the world drinking delicious cocktails.
No, and meeting people who are jazzed up about it. Can it be better, right?
It is fun. It's all exhausting, especially as I'm getting older. But and once the pandemic hit, I took on a stronger role here as chief operating officer and overseeing the operation because we kept my father out because he's now 82. He's still here. You'll find him on a forklift. He'll never retire. So we now currently have three generations, 8th, 9th, and 10th, working together, which is kind of crazy in itself.
Awesome.
My son, Gerard, came on board in 2018. And he worked down at the distillery first, and now he's doing a lot with production, and he is overseeing the implementation of our new software system.
Fantastic.
Which is perfect. He's the younger one, understands it a lot more than my father and I do.
Great. So. Was there a tradition in the family to have a particular product on Thanksgiving or the different holidays around the year, and was there kind of a mentorship of learning how to taste brandy? How did that happen in your family or for you?
It was always around. I mean, that's pretty much all my father drinks, unless he's drinking beer. When I was young, I probably as soon as I could hold a glass on a bottle, I was making his cocktail for him. So obviously I was tasting a little bit, bartenders have to make sure their cocktails are balanced correctly. So I've been exposed to it all of my life. But one family tradition that really stands out is the holidays. We have an old family Laird's eggnog recipe. So every year my father would make that. And I still, he makes me pretty much do it. He's like, "I'm passing it on to you now."
It's a little bit of work putting that together.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, so it, that was always a tradition.
Yeah. And that's cut with what? What do you put in the eggnog?
No, it's eggs, cream, applejack, sugar. Very heavy, very rich, very not calorie conscious whatsoever.
No, it shouldn't be that eggnog.
It is so delicious. Yeah. And I actually, I make a lot during the holidays, and I give everybody a little bottle of the eggnog. Mm. And I start, I don't know why I started this, because now I created a monster.
Oh, no.
Everybody's like, are we getting our eggnog?
Yeah.
So, and it's quite, you know, it's labor intensive, but I do love making it, and I love sharing it, obviously.
That's super special. Well, I ask that because I just have this imagery of, you know, your father maybe saying, you know, this is how you actually, you know, have a glass of brandy, and this is how you actually, you know, not, you know, shaking it all up, but, you know, taking in slow and munching it and not, you know, gurgling in your mouth.
We taste barrel samples together, and his, you know, he's been doing it since he was like in his 20s, and he's 80 now. So he can just smell the brandy and tell you if it has too much aldehyde, if it has too much fusel oils. Like, he can pick things up immediately. Sure. His palate is, and his nose and palate are so in tune with the product.
Yeah.
So it really takes a lot of practice. So I learn a lot from him even today. You know, as we're tasting, he'll say, oh, fusel oils are high in that. I'm like, well,
What are you noticing there? What are you picking up?
What's telling you that? Just so I can learn more. And we're now, my son Gerard is involved as well. So we're learning the process and tasting. And
that's a master.
It is. It really is.
That's a 10,000 hours plus, you know, a lifetime of hours to get that. And that is where you get that really upscale level of product.
I think one, you know, important key, being able to continue the family legacy, is that the family has found a way to always communicate. My father and I worked together for many years now. Obviously, we disagree, and there's going to be arguments at times, but we never take that home with us. We've been able to keep it separate. And I think
how do you do that? I just need to know. Yeah, what's the advice on that?
You know, it's I love my dad, and he loves me, and we respect each other. But we know we're going to argue and we're going to disagree. We still disagree to today, but we don't take it home. And I think my mother has a lot to do with that all, because she'd be like, "Eh, that's enough. We're not doing it. No more discussion about the company."
Good.
But also, you have to realize it's not personal. That
it's
they're
business.
Not.
It's one is business and one is personal.
And he's got one mindset. I have another. Obviously, you've got the conservative. You've got the younger. Now I've got even the younger. Yeah. I'm in the middle of the two of them. But you see these family businesses where they have feuds, and it tears apart the company. And I think that's really important what we've been able to do. And I think it's keep it separate.
Well, that speaks volumes for respect for boundaries, doesn't it?
You have to. You have to.
Yeah. And that, that's a skill.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's times we've had blowouts, you know, but we cool off. We still love each other. He's still my dad. I'm still his favorite daughter because I'm his only daughter.
You can own that.
And we get through it. We don't carry it with us because how can I hate my father? I don't understand that. So I think that's really, it's so key in a family business. You've got to realize it's not personal.
Well, that's good wisdom, because I know a lot of people listening have businesses that are 1, 2, 10, 20, 30 years old, hoping to become 100-year-old companies, and to be able to pass that torch on and on. Your family is a role model for all.
And you have to listen to each other. He's got good ideas. Sometimes I have good ideas, and same with my son, you know. There's new blood, and the reason you want the new generation to come in is for new blood, so the company can adjust, because the world is changing. Every generation, the world changes, and you have to adjust to it.
Yeah. Well, I think that it kind of all makes sense, because there was ingenuity way back in 1698 all the way through for your family to kind of go with the ebbs and flows of the economy, and that maybe those norms were established early on as a pattern of how to get along in the world. And that can't ever be underestimated of what it's provided for you now in 2022.
Absolutely.
Well done.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
We're trying.
And you're doing it. You're doing it.
This family is definitely doing it right, keeping family forward and keeping business as business. In part two, which will be going live next week in episode 334, you're going to be meeting Gerard, who is Lisa's son, and Larry Lairs, who is Lisa's father. They're all on site at the Scobieville plant, and that's just an amazing conversation. I don't even want to get into it right now. Definitely, if you haven't followed Cider Chat yet, please do, because you don't want to miss this opportunity to get some behind-the-scenes conversations with the Lairs family. And I want to mention that I did have the opportunity to have the Lisa cocktail, which is going to be served at the Cider Days 2.0 Cider Dinner on November 5th. She made it. I took a video of that. That's going to be up live at both the Cider Chat YouTube channel and on Instagram. So make sure to follow all those different social media channels for Cider Chat, because we are going to be throwing out more and more Lairs info and, of course, more about the Cider Days 2.0. If you want to get Lairs and you don't know how to do that, go to the show notes for this year episode. You'll have a link to their website and some of the things that we're talking about here. Oh, I just adored this woman. She's so cool. And not only for this conversation, but a little bit what you'll be hearing next week, what she was able to do for me while we were walking around the barrel room. That's a story unto itself. If you've listened this far in the podcast, obviously, I think you're getting some value. I sure hope you are. Man, this conversation with Lisa was just so wonderful. Something I've wanted to do for so long. We have next week's episode with the Lairs family, too, coming up. That's fantastic. If you believe in the podcast, you want to keep it on the air and keep on bringing out these kinds of stories, do consider becoming a sponsor of Cider Chat, like the good folks at Fermentis.com. Or just hit the donate button at ciderchat.com, like Ambrosia Borowski, who has been a supporter of the podcast for years, or Eleanor Leger of Eden Specialty Ciders, who does hit that donate button and support us each and every month. And then there's also the fine folks, both commercial makers and cider fans and enthusiasts, who are patrons at the Cider Chat Patreon page, many of which I hope to see at Cider Days 2.0. In fact, I know I'm going to be seeing you there, and I cannot wait. So no need to be shy. Join all the good people of Ciderville and helping to keep cider going up and Cider Chat on the air. You'll find all those links to all those opportunities at ciderchat.com. And with that, I leave you here. This is Rhea Windcaller signing off for now. Looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
Strange apples, bitter sharp. Strange apples, juicy and ripe. Ba 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 da do do da ba 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 da do do da. Who wants a tannin ball?
I want a tannin balm.
Who wants to pull them down?
I'm gonna pull them down. Hey, 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 apples, bittersweet.
Strange apples,
hanging high.
Got them strange apples,
forget the pie.
Strange apples,
squeeze them tight.
Got them
strange apples. Strange apples. Strange apples. Make them pop. Pop, pop, pop. Ba-dum doo-dee-dop, pop, pop, pop. Ba-dum doo-dee-dop. Who wants a tannin balm?
I want a tannin balm.
Who wants to pull them down?
I'm gonna pull them down. Hey, 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 apples.
Come and see. Plenty strange apples for you and me. Strange apples. Strange apples. Strange apples. Make them pop.
Pop, pop, pop.
Ba-da, do-do-da, pop, pop. Pop, ba-da, do-dee-da, pop, pop, pop. Ba-da, do-dee-da, pop, pop, pop. Pop, 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 pop.
Yee-haw!